Moncrief on News Talk.
We are joined once again by Dean McGuinness, Fionnuala Jones and Esther McCarthy. Good afternoon to you all.
Hi, Sean.
Hello, Sean.
How are you?
Hi, Sean.
Dean, your beers, the bottles look very fancy.
We have got Belgian beers. I have a soft spot for Belgian beers, but we're doing a kind of a compare and contrast. So we're looking at fermentation, and we're looking at a particular type of fermentation, a farmhouse ale fermentation. So it's an ale fermentation, top fermentation. The yeast rises to the top at the end, but it's a multi-strain yeast. And what we've got is we've got two different beers, both using the same ale, both using the same hop bill in the beers, using different malts and then coming out with radically different flavors in them. So the first one is Waterloo Récolt, and the second one is Waterloo Récolt Hever. So they're both farmhouse ales, and the Hever is the winter seasonal version of the farmhouse ale.
Okay, what does Récolt mean?
I have no idea. I didn't check that.
Oh, right. Okay. That was in some fancy brewing term or something.
I have no idea. I'll have to check that.
Yeah, they maybe just made it up to make it sound fancy.
And they put an accent on it as well, so
right,
it's definitely authentic.
And from the sound of these sound like you're, you know, a light frothy drink at 9% ABV type thing.
No, we're not too bad. We're at 6%. The thing about it's like reasonable for Belgian ales. It's kind of where they start out at. Now, the thing about farmhouse ales is they range from kind of down around 2-2.5% up to 9-12%. It's a really diverse family of styles of beers. And what it is like it's literally beers that were brewed in farmhouses. So the defining characteristic of the beer is where it's brewed, as opposed to exactly what the beer is about. So the color ranges from pale gold through to very dark in different beers, obviously not in the same beer. And the alcohol content ranges from quite low, you know, the type of beer that a farmhouse worker might have at lunchtime, knowing that he has to go back and work in the afternoon, through to kind of 9-10%, which would be something that you'd use as a winter warmer in the winter time.
Yeah, and they say life in the old days was hard. Everyone was half caught, really. That's the truth of it, really. Football documentary is your favourite genre, Esther.
I am a bit of a fan of them, actually, to be honest. Yeah. Though I have to admit, I have never seen The Sopranos. I am one of those weirdos.
Wow.
Never gotten around to it.
Well, let me read you out two texts. One person says, my husband refuses to watch The Sopranos because there are too many series of it. I know. I ask myself why we're together at times too. Somebody else has texted in to say they only finished the last episode of The Sopranos last night. And they're probably online right now reading 30,000 word essays explaining what exactly that last scene meant. And I'm not kidding you, that's true. By the way, Dean, récolte, whatever it is a French word meaning harvesting or the harvest crop.
That's it. Yeah, I just looked it up on Google as well myself.
Yeah, there you go. It was probably you that texted in. Yeah.
Trick is to be one page ahead rather than one page behind the audience.
Right, so sorry, Esther, to interrupt you there. This one is about Pele, the first one.
Yeah, it's lovely. And actually, just a little tip on this one. I interviewed the filmmakers during the week, two young British lads, and they kind of sent out a general request before I watched it, asking that we not watch the dubbed English version, that we watch it in Portuguese with subtitles. And it's a really good call, because just to hear all these people talking in their native language and just the va-va-voom of it all, and to hear the lads all shouting goal for 10 seconds flat, and it just brings that spirit of the country to the film, I think. And it's a really lovely film, this. I wasn't very familiar with his World Cups. Like, they were, I don't often get to say this anymore, Sean, but they were a bit before my time. So while I'd have known what a legend he was, and I always saw that show-stopping smile of his that would just stop your heart, really. I always admired him, but I never actually saw the football. And there's a wealth of footage here, brilliant footage. And I think what it does as well, it moves beyond football a little and kind of sets this time, this of his career, against the backdrop of the huge amount of social and political unrest that was going on in Brazil at the time, that was living under a dictatorship, essentially, during some of those latter years. And I think it frames that really well in terms of, but a really, really interesting history lesson in and of itself, but also how people, the people of Brazil, never needed him more than when he came along, really.
Right,
so
okay.
It's very sweet.
I imagine this isn't the first time he's been the subject of a documentary. There's probably been loads of them made about him.
There's been a couple, but I don't think there's been a definitive one. I think this one comes close. I mean, there are flaws with it. I think it's you're not in Asif Kapadia territory here with that brilliant filmmaker, or Kevin MacDonald, who really seem to be able to know what makes their subject tick. I think he's a tricky character to read, Pelle, I think, and I think that just is what it is, you know. Rather than a failure as a film, you know.
Well, that actually makes it more interesting if the documentary admits this guy is hard to read, to know
totally
exactly what's going on.
And actually, it makes some little moments that we'll talk about a bit later very, very big as well, I would say.
Yeah. And secondly, I Care a Lot. That's the name of a movie. I personally don't care about anything.
I too didn't care a lot for I Care a Lot, I have to say. And I was kind of looking forward to this because it's very, very highly rated on Rotten Tomatoes. Didn't read any of the reviews, but I occasionally have a peek at the percentage numbers. And this one looked good. It's got a great cast. Rosamund Pike, Peter Dinklage, Diane Weist, an actor I've always loved, and Chris Messina. So, you know, it centres on this legal guardian who's kind of worked the law in the US so that she can exploit the elderly. Basically, she is in the care home industry and she can become the legal guardian. There's a load of people in on the act here. It's very far-fetched. I didn't believe a minute of it. I think that's the problem. And they are going for that kind of... They are going for that, in fairness. Tonally, that's what they're trying to do. It's kind of a social satire and it's supposed to be a clever takedown of greed and capitalism. I get it, but I just didn't believe it.
Right, fair enough. Somebody's texting to say, I read that Matthew McConaughey was going to get the role of Jack in Titanic, but then Leo nabbed it at the last minute. What a different movie that would have been with a Texan in the lead role. I never heard that before.
That would have been interesting.
Yeah, that would have been very interesting. Fionnuala, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Sean. How are you?
Not too bad. Well, you know, when people say not too bad, you know, we were living through a pandemic. Who's good in this particular set of situations?
Truly.
So we might as well start off with the less jolly news. This is FKA Twigs has given her first interview about the whole Shia LaBeouf thing. I think where's he now? Is he kind of locked away someplace?
Yeah, he's kind of gone to ground, understandably. He's denied a lot of these allegations. For anyone who doesn't know FKA Twigs, I'm sure a lot more people would know her for her music. But she did star alongside Shia in Honey Boy, and they were together at the time. But yeah, she filed a lawsuit at the end of last year against him, accusing him of relentless abuse, sexual battery, assault, infliction of emotional distress. As I said, he's denied everything, kind of haven't heard anything from him since. And she was interviewed recently by Gail King on TV, in which she put the question to her and kind of phrased it in a way that she wasn't blaming her and just kind of wanted to open up that conversation as to why she didn't leave the relationship. And she gave a really good response herself, saying, I know that you're asking it out of love, but I'm just going to make a stance and say I'm not going to answer that question anymore, because the question should really be to the abuser, why are you holding someone hostage with abuse? Really grim story, as you said. She did another interview with Elle magazine recently as well about the accusations, and she said that when they were promoting the movie ahead of Sundance, whatever, it seemed like his team were just determined to turn a blind eye to what was allegedly happening. It seemed like the movie was more important to them and everything else. So we'll have to see how this goes on. I think we've talked about it briefly on the show previously about his kind of run-ins with Olivia Wilde on the set of Don't Worry Darling. Again, all alleged, but apparently they didn't get on at all, and his behaviour on set is why he ended up leaving the movie and was replaced with Harry Styles. So really sad story, really, really sad. But he's had this kind of reputation for a very long time, so I am kind of happy for this reckoning, to be honest.
Yeah, I think he has problems of his own. There's something severely wrong there.
Yeah, he said to the New York Times, actually, he gave a statement saying, I'm not in a position to tell anyone how my behaviour made them feel. But he said he's struggled with alcoholism, aggression, and yeah, basically tried to put it down to that and his history, and just tried to say he was sorry to those he hurt. But we'll have to see how the lawsuit plays out.
Yeah. Esther, is his career finished?
I don't know. It's a tricky one. I mean, people have come back from stuff like this in the past. The question now is, I guess, whether in the current climate since Me Too, whether that is a possibility anymore. I think you would have to justify casting. I think with alcohol and drug abuse, what can often come into play is it's Hollywood, it's money. That's what can come into play. If you're uninsurable on a film set due to whatever issues you might have, that's when it becomes really problematic for you, I think, if it's bad for business. I'm sorry if that sounds terribly cynical, but it's the fact of it.
Yeah, and plus also imagine if people just, you know, would refuse to work with them.
Yeah, that could happen. That could happen. People can come back as well, though. You know, I mean, I'm not the one to say whether he deserves a shot at redemption or not, or how much of this has been going on over the years. But it'll be very interesting to see what he chooses to do and how he chooses to evaluate. Because I think before this news came out, you know, you've touched on it there yourself, Sean. I think there was always something a little odd about Shia LaBeouf, even in terms of how he handled his publicity and stuff. So there's always something a little off, I think. And it'll be interesting to see if other people, I know a couple of other people have come out and talked about his behaviour in the past. So it'll be interesting if that becomes, I suppose, a storm. I think that could be where he would be in real trouble.
Right. So, Dean, tell us about our first beer today.
Okay, so the first one we're tasting is Waterloo Occult. So this is the year-round farmhouse ale. Now, the other name for the farmhouse ale style is Saison. Farmhouse ale or Saison, it's a wide range of different styles. There are a number of more traditional farmhouse ale styles starting to emerge, and it's going to be a thing over the next 2, 3, 4 years. So Sati from the Scandinavian countries is another one, which is virtually unavailable in Ireland. I haven't seen any in Ireland, possibly just home brewers doing versions of them. But bit by bit, you're finding that these types of more obscure styles are coming about. Now, what's nice about today, we have two different beers, both from the same brewery. They are both brewed using the same yeast, but the liquid that the yeast is fermenting is different. So they've used a different malt bill, and the malt is the grains that are used in brewing the beer. The first one is used using old pale malts, so the colour of the beer comes out as a pale gold colour with a kind of a ghostly haze to it. The second one is a mahogany brown beer, so you have darker malts being used. And those malts contribute starch, which is converted into sugar in the mash tun. And then that sugary liquid is what is fermented. And you get different character depending on the base liquid that's being fermented. So with this gold one, often the flavors that come through are kind of hinted at by the color of the beer. With this gold one, the key fruit flavor that's coming through is lemon. And it's kind of an array of different lemon flavors, lemon rind, kind of lemon sherbet, lemon citrus, a sweet lemon tart type of character. It's complemented by stone fruit flavors, so kind of a peach character that comes through in the background. And then with the multi-strain ale yeast that's used in fermenting the beer, that develops a whole range of spice character. It's kind of a Moroccan spice character that comes through in the beer, so clove, cardamom pods, cinnamon, white pepper, nutmeg, and a kind of phenolic character, which is kind of a warming organic character. There's a bit of nettles that comes through as well, a kind of a tingly herbal character that comes through. Absolutely lovely beer. What's interesting with it is the compare and contrast. There's a company called White Labs that operate in both California and also in Denmark. And something that they do is kind of the opposite of what we're doing today. What they do is they get a liquid and different yeast strains and put it into the same liquid and show you what different yeast strains will do to the same liquid. In this case, what we're doing is we've got the kind of same yeast strain and then different liquids, and we've got to compare and contrast on the flavors that come through as a result.
Right. Okay. Rachel has a question for you. Is it possible to find Ichnusa Non Filtrata, a Sardinian beer in Dublin? Absolutely love it. I've never seen The Sopranos either. Obviously not, because maybe you have seen it, but you can't remember because you're drinking what sounds like, I don't know what it is. Have you heard of this beer?
There are a huge number of Italian craft breweries. In Italy, it seems that the younger generation has really embraced beer. They kind of perceive wine as being something that their parents drink. And there's been a huge craft beer movement that has developed in Italy. Now, the craft beer movement in Italy is something similar to Ireland, insofar as you have a lot of quite small breweries. There's only about 15, 20 breweries that are really of a scale that they could export. And even of those, there's only about three or four of them that are actually exporting. So it is something, if you're in Italy, it's a wonderful thing to do, to go around and to taste different local beers. It's not one that I have come across. I haven't been in Italy in a few years. Last time I was in Italy, I broke my leg, so that put a dampener on that one. But they've got a whole range of styles, Doppio Molto and quite malty beers, and also some superb craft beer interpretations of New World styles as well. So it's really interesting to taste them.
And Malcolm and Marie, which Esther reviewed a few weeks back, is that fast becoming the Irishman of 2021. I didn't think I would watch a film as annoying as Marriage Story, but Malcolm and Marie has managed to achieve that with two more characters you would wish were on the Sopranos hit list. Nothing worse than watching affluent whining couples complaining about their first world problems, says Owen. You know what? It sounds like, though, that they perform so well as possibly annoying people that they come across as annoying.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some very funny takes on Twitter on it as well. Someone put up, so there's a whole scene where he keeps going in and outside, in and out of the back patio, and she's trying not to laugh. It's quite a funny scene when he's in sight, but she's laughing like mad when he's not. But he's out in the back garden, roaring his head off. And like a lot of people, I was going, it's bad enough now, lads, living in a pandemic without having Malcolm Malcolm next door to you, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a load of takes on that. There's been some really funny tweets of people pretending that they live next door to Malcolm, which is quite amusing.
Right.
But yeah, it is. It's two people shouting at each other for 2 hours. I get it. If that's too relatable at the moment.
Yeah,
you know?
That does sound a bit like lockdown. Fionnuala, have you seen Malcolm and Marie?
Yes, I was just about to say, I actually did watch it over the weekend and I didn't think I'd like it, but I really did. I think the two of them, like Zendaya and John David Washington, are so strong. Now, I will say I can understand people's annoyance. I feel like if we were living in a different climate, like maybe I think people would enjoy it more, but I feel like because everything is just so grim and tetchy as it is, I can understand why people were like, oh my God, bore off to these two people. But also agree with Esther, I've seen some really funny videos of like dogs just barking at each other and it's like Malcolm and Marie like 2021, and I've laughed so much at them.
It's the movie version of leaving your Christmas tree up, from the sounds of it. The hashtag is clumsy movies when Harry wet Sally, being one instance of that. Don't think about that one for too long. Esther, would you like to talk about Pelé first?
Oh, absolutely. We need Pelé at the moment, I think.
Okie dokie. All right, Pelé coming up after this.
Pelé vinha do colégio e era só brincar com bola.
E depois de ter sido convocado então para a seleção, a alegria foi enorme, viu?
E a gente via que ali estava realmente nascendo o maior jogador de futebol de todos os tempos.
There you go, one for the Portuguese speakers among you, of course, of which Esther McCarthy is one. I suppose people would know, a lot of people at least would know the vague outlines of the story of Pelé.
Yeah, but this is really workmanlike. It's really good documentary making in the sense it's not maybe shouty or cinematic, although that's a bit unfair. There's some amazing archive footage here, but I suppose not as much of a masterpiece as some of the great, great documentaries we've seen in recent years, like Senna or the Amy Winehouse doc, stuff like that. But I think it's really workmanlike in the best possible way, in that the research it's gone into here and the detail it gives you from two young British directors by the name of David Trihorn and Ben Nicholas. And I'm going to just flag this, Sean, in case I forget. It's coming to Netflix, but it's not on Netflix this weekend. It's landing on Tuesday. Next Tuesday, February 23rd, okay, in case people go looking for it. So I think, like, he is a more benign and less complex character than, say, a Maradona, which is another great documentary from recent years. But this takes a different approach, I think. It sets his story against the political turmoil in his home country at the time, particularly in the late 60s, when, you know, there was very few privileges. The horribly named 1968 Institutional Act Number 5, where the military were taking away many of the country's freedoms at that stage. They'd already staged a coup, and the Brazilian people had lived under that for many years. And there was a lot of unrest around this time. And, you know, Pelé kind of continued to play football and remain apolitical to quite a lot of criticism by other people in the film, I found interesting. And he addresses that as well. But like, it's framed really around four World Cups. But there's some delightful early footage. Like, he was a shoeshine boy as a child. He grew up in poverty and he tried to support his parents by shining shoes as a child. And he still has the box now, Sean. And he drums on the box. Like, he's 80 now and he can't stand unaided anymore. So it's a little shock to the system when you see him first. But he's still just got all of this personality, you know, and he drums on the box and it's kind of a little samba beat every now and then when he's trying to make a point. And I just love those little touches in it, I think. So he's, you know, you learn all the stuff that football fans will know, you know, how he got drafted to play for Santos when he was still in his teens and how Brazil quickly got wind of him and wanted him to play in the 1958 World Cup. He had always loved football because his father had always told him, on the pitch, everyone is equal. Now, I'm not sure people who play against Pele would feel that way, but that was the philosophy behind it. And, you know, that's lovely detail. And it's because, you know, he captured the imagination. Then you kind of go, how did you manage that level of fame at 17 and not become totally a car crash, you know? Because, you know, his debut in 58 was he returned home national hero, basically. And Brazil then famously defended its title 4 years later. But we know what happened in 1966, right? We're still here. We haven't heard the end of it yet. So Brazil had a bad time that year. And by then, Pelé was being targeted, I suppose, by rival players throughout the tournament. You know, so he was introduced to the lows as well as the highs, and he was forced out of that tournament, and Brazil were forced out of that tournament very early. And he's kind of said, that's it, I'm done, and I'm not coming back to play in 1970. But his country wanted him, his country needed him, and he was compelled to go back. And it's very, very moving. He talks about, you know, first of all, the footage of the 1970 Brazil versus Italy final in Mexico. If you've never seen it, just watch him play, or watch that whole team, and you just go, oh my God, they're not footballing, they're dancing. They're actually dancing. And just the skill and the talent of that team is something to behold. But also, like, he's kind of letting on he didn't want to play in 1917 and he didn't care. And then he just completely breaks down as an 80-year-old man now, as he talks about the night before the final, that he prayed to God to help him win, to help Brazil win, because he knew how much his people, who were being treated terribly by their own military, needed that win at that stage. And it's very moving. Like, he starts sobbing and he's been as cool as a cucumber the whole way through, you know, flashing that smile that he still has. And I think what's a workmanlike first hour documentary making becomes something very, very special in the second hour.
Do they manage to explain that, though? Why this guy didn't get, and you know, you made the comparison with Maradona, why this guy didn't get destroyed by all that? You know, he was the best player in the world.
I mean, it just never comes up. I think maybe one factor might be he stayed with the same club throughout his entire career. I think that's probably a safety net for him. He toured with them a lot. Now, it did lead, like, he did have kids around the place, and it did lead to the breakup of his first marriage, you know. So he's not painted as a saint either, but he just seems like a very balanced kind of character, and frustrating in some ways for documentary makers, I think. And you know, he addresses what's really of interest to me was, like, why didn't you come out against these guys? Why did you do the photo opportunities with these terrible leaders, you know? And he's kind of shrugging, and he says, and you just have to take him at his word, I think. He kind of says, you know, he was always apolitical. He was never going to get involved in politics. And he felt that his country needed his football. And it doesn't feel like he's writing that off, actually. I think he suffered for it. And I think even some of his own teammates in the management structure who played with him at the time are quite critical of him in the film for it. And I think there's just a kind of truth and simplicity to him or something, and he's just like, football is what I am, and it's who I am, and that's it, you know.
Yeah, that's a lovely
very
thing.
Good.
On that beer that was being asked about, someone texted in to say it's pronounced Ichnusa. It can be found in Mona Lisa's restaurant in Goa, which is owned by a chef from Sardinia. I don't know if you can find it there now. And it's also available in Fresh on Camden Street. So depending on what side of the country you're on, there's two places you could potentially get it. Right, Fionnuala, let's talk politics. And the next movie star president is going to be The Rock.
Yes, cannot wait. Dwayne The Rock Johnson is giving everyone what they want by potentially running for the US presidential election. He's mentioned this before. So he mentioned an interview with GQ in 2017 where he basically said he'd like to see greater leadership, kind of referenced Trump not being a big fan of the media and the media not being a big fan of Trump. And it's come up again recently because there's a new comedy series out called Young Rock, which is based on Johnson's early life. And he makes appearances throughout the series. And there's one point where he's seen running for president in the year 2032. So off the back of that, he's said, yeah, I would consider presidential run in the future if that's what the people wanted. I'm not flippant in any way with my answer. That would be up to the people. So I'm going to put the question to the people. Do they want Dwayne The Rock Johnson as US president? Do we need another celebrity as president? I would probably I'd probably say no. He could be up against Kanye again. Kanye might run again if the two of them do decide to run again. Want to see that just for my own
entertainment. I want to see that debate. Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, exactly.
When he says it's up to the people, is there some mechanism by which the people let him know, or he's like hearing voices
he'll probably do an Instagram poll or something, I'd imagine. That's how they all do it.
That's what makes it the greatest democracy in the world. We do have one more movie, one more beer to talk about after this. 53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. Dean, Esther and Fionnuala are still with us. Dean's already told us about one beer. Now he's going to talk about its cousin. So off you go, Dean.
Okay, so yeah, the second beer we've got is Waterloo Récolte Hiver, and this is a seasonal winter farmhouse ale. Now, with farmhouse ales, oh, by the way, just something to throw in there as well, just a piece of news that I came across that I thought was interesting, and if anybody from the Irish government is listening in, it would be something worth considering. Apparently in Tel Aviv, they've really got ahead with vaccinating in Israel, but in Tel Aviv, something that they're doing at the moment is they're giving out free alcohol to anybody who comes to a bar to get vaccinated. So when they're distributing the vaccine, they figure that people kind of around 20 to 30 are dying to get back to bars. They figure the easiest way to get them vaccinated is to do the vaccination at bars and to give them a free drink if they do it.
Yeah, I don't think we need that encouragement somehow.
So I figure any Irish politician who wants to guarantee their election, tell people that, you know, they're being let out of lockdown by being vaccinated and there's free alcohol involved as well. I think it's a guaranteed recipe for success. But in any event, our second beer, Waterloo Récolte Hiver. It's a dark farmhouse ale. So with both of these beers, the yeast that's being used in fermenting the beer is a multi-strain yeast. And what that means is that yeast is a microorganism, a tiny organism that goes around and eats the sugar in the sugary liquid, the unfermented beer. And those organisms, they can have certain characteristics. So yeast from a single strain will all have the same characteristics. And then if you have a number of different strains, so a number of kind of different types of yeast all in the same culture, that's called a multi-strain yeast. The result is that the different strains kind of do slightly different jobs from each other. They develop different flavors. So when you've got a multi-strain yeast, you get a much more complex flavor in the beer. A lot of the mainstream beers would be brewed with single-strain yeasts because it makes things very easy in production terms. So if you've got a huge brewery and if you want the beer to be incredibly reliable every single time and don't want to be in a situation where the beer is out of specification in terms of quality. If you've got a single strain yeast, then that single strain is going to do the same job all the time. If you're looking for something that's kind of more interesting, has more depth of character, more artistic, then a multi-strain yeast would give an awful lot more character. The Chimay yeast, for example, a brewing scientist called Jean de Klerk analyzed the Chimay yeast and identified 50 separate individual yeast strains in the beer. And it gives an incredibly complex fermentation character. With this beer, then this multi-strain yeast is working on dark sugars from dark malts. So mid-color and dark malts will give kind of more caramelly type sugars into the unfermented beer. And then when they ferment, they come through as more kind of fruitcake flavors. So you've got a whole kind of kaleidoscope of dark fruit flavors in this: dried fruit, prunes, juicy dates, figs. There's a certain amount of kind of sour cherry, sour lemon flavor coming through. Black currant juice. There's a note of cola cube and candied fruit coming through. And then that's balanced out with a bit more of that nettle character that was in the first beer as well. And a bit more kind of white pepper and nutmeg spice character. So what you've got is, with these two beers, two very different characters. And what that's coming from is the fermentation, which is a very natural process, the yeast working on these different types of sugars and then changing those sugar flavors into very, very different flavors. It's really interesting to compare and contrast the two flavors that result.
Right. OK. Given that, given what you said, some of the hints of flavor in that beer, Phil has a question. Well, it's actually four questions as I count it. Here it is anyway. Are these chocolatey coffee stouts absolute nonsense? What does Dean reckon? What's wrong with a straightforward stout? Am I just being an old curmudgeon? I'm guessing your answer is nothing and yes.
Pretty much.
Right, okay.
Yeah, sometimes they... Thank God.
We can move swiftly on then from... Because we have done them here and it's not... They don't taste like... There's hints of it, but they're quite delicious. And we've had them with ice cream
really
and everything.
Beautiful flavor. And sometimes just from the dark malts, I've had a chocolate bock beer, which is incredibly chocolatey and not a touch of chocolate used in it, just all from the dark malt flavor.
Mm-hmm. Somebody else wants to know, where can they buy Cantillon... I think we've been asked about this before. Cantillon Foo Foon beer in Ireland or online?
Yeah, I'd say the Beer Club or Martin's do an excellent range of beers. Lambic, it's a superb beer. There's a range of different beers from Cantillon, so you just have to check and make sure that you're getting the right one, because they have a few different sour beers that they do.
Right, okay, we'll move on to our second movie of the day. It is I Care A Lot. Here's a clip.
You hold stock in Golden Light Care Homes, right?
Yeah, we have a chunk.
Sign some over to me. Come on. I'm helping you feed the money monster, but I hardly see any of the gold for myself. Give me a taste.
Done. But it has to be a real cherry, bona fide.
Jennifer Peterson.
She's in reasonably good health, but recently she has shown some signs of memory loss and confusion.
Significant.
No, but we can tickle that to make an emergency hearing go our way. She has no kids, no husband. No living family.
No family at all.
She has very good insurance.
Can I get a copy of all this?
You bet. I'll accept her test results. That wouldn't be ethical.
Right, that's I Care A Lot. Actually, Maeve in Galway says, I don't know what it is about Rosamund Pike, but she's a great villain. She does a great sinister smile. Is she a great villain in this?
She's great in it, and so is Diane Weist. They're both great in it. Cast are really good, but... I'm glad you played that clip there, because that's the problem right there. Like, the premise of this, just because you're a satire and a black comedy doesn't mean that you get away with so many bloody implausibilities in your setup and throughout your script. You know, it doesn't work that way. Just because it's a bit heightened doesn't mean you can have so many gaps in your storytelling. And what we're being asked to believe there is that Marla Grayson, who's a court-appointed guardian for the elderly and infirm, who has... like this business going of care facilities, we're expected to believe that she is talking to this woman's GP, who's calling her a cherry because she has no relatives and is very wealthy, and therefore they're going to get a court order because that's going to, you know, wash by a judge, and they're going to pretend that her slight forgetfulness of recent times is worse than it actually is, you know, with no medical evidence to back that up. And they're going to go into a court, and Marla Grayson's character is going to be able to move this woman out of her home, sell her house, and have her incarcerated. Like, I'm sorry, I'm not buying it. I was actually looking at some of this stuff going, is this even a law? Like, so that was my problem. It lost me early. There's another stage where Diane Weist's character, who's had terrible stuff imposed on her and has been very, very heavily medicated, in a scene with Rosamund Pike, comes up with one of the best moments in the film, some of the best lines of dialogue in the film, which is great. It's great fun as a scene, but the woman is supposed to be heavily, heavily medicated, and you're expecting me to believe that. So I just didn't buy it. You know, I didn't buy the setup. I get that it's a kind of takedown of greed and capitalism. And it's set around Rosamund Pike's character, who is, you know, on the make from these elderly and infirm people, and using that power and influence to kind of distance them from their families, to grow her nursing home business and to basically get rich off the industry of nursing home care. And I'm just not sure this year of all years that I'm on board with that as a comedic idea or concept anyway. Yeah. I'm sorry. She's offered what's known in the her racket as a cherry, which is, a retirement age woman played by Diane Rust, who's actually really good here. Everyone's talking about Rosamund Pike, but I think she's really great here. So in no time at all, she, because this woman has no living heirs or family, she's quick to get her put into care. But she is messing with the wrong woman, let's say, because Jennifer Peterson is not Jennifer Peterson at all. She's another woman with a very shady past and some very nasty characters who want to track down the people behind her incarceration, including Peter Dinklage, who is just a bit too over the top here. And I get why casting agents want to cast him that way now. But I'm kind of getting tired of it as well.
Yeah.
And I want to see him back doing lovely little dramas like The Station Agent, where he first became on our radar. So all a bit too arch, way too in love with itself, and just too many weaknesses in plot to make me buy into it even as a satire. I just didn't believe it.
Right, okay. Lawrence says, I'm sad to say I've watched my first really bad Denzel Washington movie. I watched The Equalizer on Netflix. Lord, what was he thinking? Slow, incredibly violent, that kind of comes out of nowhere. No real plot or justifiable reason for the violence. Shockingly bad, says Lawrence.
Yeah, it's not great.
It's not great.
And there is all that tokenistic violence as well. I remember it jarred at me at the time when I saw it too. Yeah,
it's a bit of an odd one. And Fionnuala Cameron Diaz, she's not going to act anymore. She's retired.
Yeah, she'd announced that, was it maybe 5 years ago? Her last role was the 2014 remake of Annie, which I did not watch. I don't know if Esther did. She played Miss Hannigan, did not do well at the box office whatsoever. But she's basically kind of reiterated again, there's absolutely no way she's coming back after she became a mother in December 2019. She just said she couldn't imagine herself leaving her baby, whose name is Radix, to embark on the 14-hour shoot days.
It's called what? What's the child called?
Radix, which I'm always like, it's very shower gel.
Yeah, washing powder I would have gone with. But that's close enough. Yeah.
I will say I'm allowed to say that because my name is Fionnuala, so that's where I get my justification from. But she's basically said, look, I'm never going to say never about anything in life. I'm not that person. But she said at the minute, she's not that keen. Beyond being a full-time mammy, she's very tied up. She's a wine brand actually called Aveline, which she launched last summer. I've never had it. I'd be interested to hear if anyone else has. But that's what's keeping her busy. We won't be seeing her on screen anytime soon.
Right. Okay. But she's not at home looking after. She's probably got a person to do that stuff for her.
Yeah, I'd imagine so.
A
fleet of people. Yeah, our old team.
But like, she hasn't like got fat or anything like that, and that's why she's hiding.
No, I don't think so. She's just drinking wine and feeling fine, I think.
Okay, that's fine. And I don't know if you can answer this question, Dean, or not really you're qualified to, but somebody wants to know, would going to a bar in Israel for a vaccine constitute essential travel?
I think so, yeah.
Well, it's probably, it's worth a try, I might have thought. Esther, Dean and Fionnuala, thank you all very much. That's our lot for today. Moncrief on News Talk.